Because of the physical exhaustion caused by 2 or 3 sorties a night, we were encouraged to take a benzidine tablet on the last sortie to keep awake and active. Unfortunately, this also made it difficult to sleep afterwards, so at the end of briefing on the last mission, we were given the Navy rum ration. As Bambi didn't drink, I got his. It was not a very healthy way to live. 6. The storm. I hurried through this gloomy room and now faced an apartment which looked as though a hurricane had swept through it. The muted voices I had heard before had now risen to a crescendo. Thunder echoed around the outside of the house and sheets of lightning lit up the scene of havoc. Breakfast. His place was laid, the messroom clock struck 8, the sun shone through the window on his chair, no one commented on his fate, save for a headshake here and there. Only old George, who'd seen him die, spinning against the autumn sky, leaned forward and turned down his plate. And, as he did, the sunlight fled, as though the sky he loved so mourned her dead. John Pudney, Saturday 23rd of June, 1944, started the same as any other day. I woke tired, to the familiar patter of rain on canvas. After days of rain, I had dug a circular slit trench around the outside of the tent to drain the water away, but this had filled during the night and was now overflowing into small tributaries, turning the floor of the tent into a carpet of mud. Everything inside the tent was damp, particularly bedclothes and clothes. Bambi had a hacking cough but refused to see the doctor. With the losses since D-Day, the wing was short of crews. On the way to lunch, I fell in with my flight commander, who said, "You're in luck, Peter, the GH aircraft are all operational and group wants to put 3 aircraft onto the Cherbourg Peninsula tonight. You had better air test your aircraft this afternoon. You're a jammy sod, you will probably get away with only 1 sortie tonight." Bambi and I spent most of the afternoon on an airborne check of the GH equipment in T for Tommy. We had lost a starboard engine from light flak a few days previously, so we also gave the new one a very thorough run-up and check. As we were not on target until 2,300 hours, we spent a leisurely early evening reading the papers and lingering over supper in the mess tent. At 2,100 hours, the 3 crews on the GH detail were briefed separately on the military situation, weather, flak positions, entry and exit corridors, call signs and so forth. The Americans, having broken out of their bridgehead, were pressing down the Cherbourg Peninsula towards the port itself, without which the whole Allied advance would be in jeopardy, denied the necessary supplies and reinforcements. The 7th U.S. Corps had already begun the attack on the port but had bypassed the dominating fortification of Street-Sauve. They had, therefore, requested a bombing attack on St. Sauve prior to an assault at 2,330 hours. For once the weather over the target area was good, a break before an intense depression building up in the Atlantic moved into the area in the following 24 hours. The 3 GH aircraft were to bomb at 10-minute intervals, but in the event of any delay, no bombs were to be released after 2,325 hours. Wing Commander Blacksmith, the CO of one of the other squadrons, was in the briefing tent at the time and had previously been on night fighters. He came up to me and remarked, "I know it's difficult, but try to keep an eye open for night fighters, because if they get into the area, you're a sitting duck." Following the main briefing, we returned to the squadron dispersal as the evening closed in. Around the airfield, engines were already coughing into life as the night war in the air got underway. We changed into flying suits, collected parachutes and Mae Wests before going into the flight commander's office to sign the authorization book, which gave the bare outlines of the sortie-Blackjack 34. GH 20,000 feet. 4 500-pound bombs. Time on target 2,300 hours. Joe Bodian initialed the detail and gave the final word. "Once you've bombed, go into a steep diving turn, down to the deck and back out as fast as you can. If you have any kind of trouble, don't block the runway here, go to Manston. Peter, you should know the form by now. Any questions?" We walked out to the aircraft, and with only one sortie to complete, there was plenty of time to settle down and go through our drills methodically. My ground crew were grouped around T for Tommy, and I could just make out my crew chief, Corporal Benson. "Everything okay, Benson?"
"Fine, sir, no snags at all.
Aircrew have strong feelings about flying their own aircraft, and would rather take it with quite a lot of unserviceability if the alternative was changing to a strange one. Each aircraft seems to have its own personality and quirks. Now and again you would come up against a rogue and avoid it like the plague." I had flown T for Tommy for some time and felt very familiar and at home with it. It had taken some stick but held together well. While Bambi disappeared into the bomb bay with the armorer to check and arm the bombs, I inspected the outside of the aircraft with my torch. Tires okay, all panels secured, windscreen clean. I had often jerked into a sharp turn at the sight of a fighter which had turned out to be only a speck of dirt on the windscreen. We finally climbed into the aircraft through the small hatch on the starboard side of the aircraft, myself first, then Bambi. We strapped in, feeling our way around the cockpit, using as little light as possible to preserve night vision. Finally, Benson closed the hatch with a cheery "Good luck, sir, and please don't bring back any work tonight." After the pre-start checks, I flashed my torch through the side panel and, on getting the all-clear signal, stabbed the engine buttons. The two Merlins got easily and were soon throbbing rhythmically. These engines are inclined to overheat on the ground and have to be nursed along until opening up for takeoff. I waved the chocks away with my torch, and by the time I reached the end of the runway had already completed the takeoff checks. I stopped only briefly, flicked navigation lights on and off for takeoff. Strict radio discipline was now enforced to avoid giving the listening enemy any clues about our operations, received an immediate green all dislike from the runway caravan in return, and lined up on the runway. So as not to attract any attention at all from enemy intruders, every light on the airfield and the aircraft was kept to an absolute minimum. It is always at this point, staring into the inky blackness ahead, that my stomach turns over, like a boxer first entering the ring before the fight starts. Once I get down to work, then it is all right again. Slowly and carefully I eased the throttles forward, keeping straight down the narrow funnel of dim runway lights, using rudder and differential throttle. As full power was poured on, the Mosquito accelerated rapidly, and by 80 miles an hour, as the flying controls began to bite, you could begin to feel you had an aircraft strapped on minus 100 miles per hour, 110, 120, 130 back on the stick, harder back, and then, with a final jerk, T for Tommy became unstuck and with a full load lurched into the darkness. Thorny Island is almost surrounded by estuary, and I was conscious of the water rushing past only a few feet below. I nursed the aircraft into a climb, and once a position altimeter reading had been established, raised the undercarriage. Now clear, the Mosquito began to build up speed rapidly and climb away, and I could settle down to instrument flying. Bambi passed me a course to fly and an altitude to reach, and for once was not sick. I saw him out of the corner of my eye stick a piece of gum into his mouth and chew contentedly as he began to pore over his cheat charts. It took about 20 minutes to climb to 20,000 feet, carefully checking radiator temperatures every few thousand feet, to get the maximum rate of climb without overheating the engines. The Merlins were purring beautifully with no sign of trouble from the starboard engine, and the exhaust stubs glowed comfortingly red in the dark. I turned the cockpit lights right down until only the luminous outline of the flickering needles showed, and we became a shadow stalking down a dark starlit lane towards the Cherbourg Peninsula. Finally Bambi broke the silence. "Okay, Peter, I've picked up the lattice line and we can follow it into the target." This was the dangerous time. With small changes of course at a constant height, with pilot concentrated on instruments and the navigator with his eyes firmly glued into the visor of the GH equipment, we were an easy prey for night fighters. Left 2 degrees, left 1 degree, left another,
steady, and so on, with Bambi faithfully following the signals on his scope. 2 minutes to the outer marker, Bambi continued. I looked up from the instruments momentarily to catch the flash of guns marking the American advance down the peninsula, and then bowed my head again in concentration, since 1 degree off course, 100 feet out in height, could make a difference of hundreds of yards in bombing accuracy. Outer marker, settled down on 129 degrees dash steady, final bomb heading 125 degrees, check airspeed 240 miles per hour, height 20,000 feet. Bambi's smooth and efficient patter ran on, 1 degree left, steady, 1 minute to go, bombs selected and fused, bomb doors open now. The bomb doors opened with a rumbling sound, and flying with them open was like driving a car over cobblestones, and I had to open the throttles to keep the speed steady at 240 miles per hour, 30 seconds to go, 125 degrees, steady. I could detect the rising excitement in Bambi's voice. Inner marker, keep steady 125 degrees, steady, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, release, bombs gone. The aircraft bucked and tossed, I snapped the bomb doors closed and threw the aircraft into a spiraling dive towards home. Course 300 degrees and down to 1,000 feet, Peter, said Bambi in a more normal voice. The airspeed indicator came alive, minus 260 miles per hour, 280, 300. Suddenly the darkness outside was split by shafts of light like illuminated stair rods. Christ, what the bloody hell, and then wham! 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 The aircraft shuddered violently as though halted in its flight path by a shower of large rocks. The control column was wrenched out of my hand, and simultaneously the instruments shattered as the cockpit filled with acrid smoke. Recovering from the initial shock, I grabbed at the control column. Quick, Bambi, we've been hit. Give me a course to keep us over land. What's your damage? No answer, and out of the corner of one eye I could see Bambi still leaning over his G-box. The Mosquito was a side-by-side two-seater with the navigator slightly set back in an unarmored position, while my own back and head were protected by a shield of hardened steel. A sheet of flame spread over the starboard engine, whose temperature gauge had now run off the clock. I had no alternative but to stab the feathering button. My only concern now was with the aeroplane and the extent of its wounds. I pulled back on the control column, but there was little response as it flapped loosely in my hand, almost at the same time, if indeed there is any sequence to the death struggles of T for Tommy, a trail of sparks shot out of the port engine, followed by a loud explosion. Automatically I stabbed the port feathering button. The aircraft continued its spiraling path downwards. I could make out the rigid propellers in the glare from the burning engines, and with the Merlin's silenced, all that I could hear was the rush of air outside and the thuds as the engine disintegrated from the intense heat. I knew beyond doubt that the end was near, and there was nothing left to fly with. My whole mind and training switched to the urgent necessity of getting Bambi and myself out of what now was only a burning coffin. Bail out, Bambi. Get the door jettisoned, I yelled. There was no answer, no movement from my navigator. For Christ's sake, Bambi, get the bloody door open. The so-called door was a narrow hatch on the navigator's side, which was just large enough to squeeze through, and I knew it would have to be opened, and Bambi got out through it before I myself could exit. There was no other way. I grabbed Bambi's arm and pushed him forward onto the floor, where now my navigator showed some signs of life, fumbling with the emergency handle. Mayday, 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 Blackjack 34, bailing out. No reply, but then, clear as a bell, this is Gordon Cummings, Peter. Can I help? I am over the Cherbourg Peninsula. Gordon Cummings was the pilot of the aircraft immediately behind mine on the GHD tail. No, Gordon, we are in real trouble, bailing out, and I am going on to steady transmit, so try to get someone to get a fix on us. Suddenly the door blew off and the cockpit filled with a blast of cold air. Against the fire in the starboard engine I could now make out Bambi clearly crouched down on the floor, and I had no time to find out whether the red shadows on the back of his flying suit were from the engine on fire or some dreadful wound. "Bail out, bail out," I shouted. There was still no answer. I unstrapped, got down on the floor and, swearing, began pushing Bambi through the hatch. My whole urgent instinct was now to get clear myself. And then suddenly Bambi popped out. One moment he was there and the next gone. For 1 second I saw his white face and startled eyes, which showed no fear. I now knelt in the doorway and pushed myself outwards against the solid wall of air. The whole engine and the underneath of the nacelle were illuminated by fire and I could feel the searing heat. With one Herculean effort I was out and tumbling away from the burning aeroplane. There was no sensation of falling and I became hypnotized by the peace and silence around me after the noise and shambles of the cockpit. I suddenly realized I had to deploy my parachute, searched and scratched desperately for the D-ring, found and tugged it violently. There was a great jerk, followed by the tearing noise of the shrouds as they protested at the speed at which I was traveling through the air, placing an almost unbearable strain on the cords and panels of the chute. However, it held together, and I felt it gradually stabilizing my descent. The night was black, although I could just make out the white roof of the parachute over my head. A bright explosion not far away showed where T for Tommy hit the water, and in the short life of the burning wreckage on the sea I could just estimate that I still had about 2,000 feet to fall before the light was extinguished and the blackness closed in. I reached for my torch, normally tucked into my flying boots, only to find that both boots had been wrenched off by the force of the slipstream as I left the aircraft and the torch had gone with them. This was a bad blow, but worse was to follow. Just as I was preparing to inflate my Mae West life jacket, I hit the sea and went under. The shock of cold water and the first choking mouthful of seawater woke me to the stark reality of the situation and a new struggle began in earnest. I grasped for the handle of the air bottle on my Mae West, found and pulled it. I could hear the gas escaping and felt the bladders of the waistcoat expanding and gripping my body like a tight corset. It brought me to the surface, gasping and spluttering. At first I thought I had surfaced under a low, white cloud, but quickly realized that the parachute canopy had collapsed over me and that I was in the middle of an air pocket underneath it. I released the harness and tried to push my way clear, but the cords had tangled round my legs and as the shrouds became sodden with water so the parachute began to sink and pull me down with it. I began to struggle and swallowed more sea water. Panic overcame me and I fought to free myself. The more I fought, the more water I swallowed. Suddenly I realized that I was going to drown. Reason returned and my mind began to function logically. You are drowning because you are panicking. First stop panicking. I did, and felt more relaxed. Then I thought, you have now got to get out of the shrouds. I began to locate and feel the cords binding me to the canopy like a giant weed. I remembered the clasp knife on my flying suit and, finding it, began to cut the cords away one by one, ducking my head below the sea, finding a cord and sawing through it, coming up for air and then going down again. How long this went on for I cannot tell. It seemed a long time before the last strand was parted and exhausted, I floated free. For a while I lay riding the waves in my Mae West, but their will to survive returned and I began to think about the dinghy attached to my Mae West on a long lead. I found the lead and had soon gripped the pack. Methodically I undid the press studs around the canvas cover, pulled out the rubber innards, then slowly felt around its periphery until I located the air bottle. The air went in with a hissing rush, filling the rubber walls which grew with every second. Silence at last, and the dinghy was inflated. It required all my remaining strength to climb onto the dinghy where I lay across it, only half conscious, my cheek pressed against the bulging side. My thoughts were only of the rapid and devastating transposition from the familiar surroundings of my aeroplane, returning to base, and the unreality of this ice-cold, wet, hostile world in which I now found myself. I had no idea what had happened to my navigator. In a mosquito, the pilot sat on his parachute and dinghy pack, which were already firmly strapped to his body, whereas the navigator's parachute and dinghy were stowed away and required clipping to his harness before use. In the confusion of keeping the aircraft under some kind of control, I had no idea whether Bambi was wounded or had managed to attach both parachute and dinghy to his harness. From our drills in the swimming pool, I was aware that he was not a very good swimmer or very confident in the water. All these things passed through my mind. The sea was not very rough but was freezing cold. While it was dark, there was little I could do except shiver and wait for the dawn, which was a long time coming. With the first rays of daylight, I was able to take stock of my position. The sky and sea were cold and gray, blending together. For the first time I could make out the color and shape of the dinghy, only to realize that it was floating upside down and I had been lying across the bottom of it all night. Obviously, the first thing to do was to turn it over and get into it properly. I went into the water and it was very, very cold. With considerable effort I righted the dinghy and clambered over the side. The dinghy itself was oblong, no more really than a rubber ring with a bottom to it, but by drawing my legs up I could sit in it quite comfortably. The bottom held about an inch of water, and even with the quite calm sea, water constantly splashed over the side. There was very little in the way of equipment. All I could find was a bag attached by a piece of string to the dinghy, which would serve as a sea anchor or bailer, a pair of small bellows, thank goodness, as the dinghy was still only half inflated, and nothing else, no rations, no water or paddles. Either they had fallen out during the night while the dinghy was inverted, or they had never been there in the first place. I went through my pockets, but there was little of use in them except for the knife. At this stage, the complete lack of survival aids didn't seem very important. The whole business of righting the dinghy and settling into it must have taken about an hour, and my watch had stopped at 3 o'clock the previous night, so I reckoned it must have been about 6 o'clock in the morning. It was now getting quite light. The sky was overcast with a cloud base of about 400 feet with very poor visibility. In the light I could see blood mixing with the water in the bottom of the dinghy, and for the first time I realized I was wounded, not badly, but either shell splinters or splinters of the aeroplane caused by the shells hitting it had entered my leg. I did my best, tying a handkerchief around the wound, but it caused me no discomfort. I estimated I must be within about 20 miles of the Cherbourg Peninsula and 100 miles from England. I had been in contact with one of our aircraft before bailing out and had surely transmitted enough for someone to get a fix on my position, so there should be a reasonable hope of being picked up. So I sat shivering, thinking of a hot bath and a steaming cup of coffee. Then I heard the wonderful throb of aircraft engines in the distance, getting closer, and suddenly I saw them, two single-engine aircraft heading towards me. What were they? Spitfires or Messerschmitts? I was so cold I didn't really care, although it crossed my mind that if they were German they might shoot me up. At any rate, I waved like mad. The two aircraft turned slightly away and my heart sank, thinking they had missed me in the poor visibility, but no, they suddenly wheeled over and dived in my direction. Here it comes, I thought, and I closed my eyes. No machine guns. And I looked up as they swept overhead, Spitfires. They circled around and dived again. This time something fell from one of them and burst into smoke as it hit the sea. I paddled over with my hands to find it was only a smoke flare, but again this did not worry me. Everything was going fine and in no time a boat would be out to pick me up. The Spitfires circled low overhead once more and then skimmed low over the sea off into the mist. I listened to their engines dying away into the distance and relaxed as much as one can after a night in the water, waiting for the expected boat. My spirits were high as I waited throughout the morning, confident of being picked up. The early arrival of the Spitfires gave me a pleasant feeling of security. The weather improved a little, and for a short time the sun even shone dimly through the overcast and mist. But the hours wore on with no sign of rescue, and I made dozens of excuses for the delay. I became worried but not desperate, every minute expecting to hear the noise of a boat approaching. I was very hungry but not thirsty. It was impossible to relieve myself over the side of the boat, so I lowered my trousers and had my morning constitutional in the bottom of the dinghy. As midday approached, I became increasingly resentful towards both the Spitfires and the air sea rescue boats for taking so long. My dinghy became caught up in a tidal race, and I was swept along like a cork in a current. I knew that every minute was taking me further and further away from the position where the Spitfires had found me. The tidal race must have taken me near land, as I could just make out the blur of a coastline on the horizon. The relief of seeing what could be sanctuary was too much, and I slipped over the side of the dinghy and started to swim towards land. I was a good swimmer, but with a May West on, it only took about 50 yards to make me realize that I might make a mile at the most, and trying to swim ashore was as good as committing suicide. I turned around and could only just make out the dinghy bobbing now about a good 200 yards away. I was now in a panic to get back to the only security I knew. It was an awful struggle, but I finally made it and just managed to climb back in and collapse, exhausted. I knew I had made a terrible mistake, one which had nearly cost me my life and weakened me so much that it might yet do so. My only chance of being saved was to stick to the dinghy, however close I might come to land again. During the afternoon the wind sprang up and the sea became rougher. The awful exertions of the previous 18 hours had taken their toll, so I sat quite comatose, with eyes half closed, lulled by the waves smacking and rocking the dinghy, but still believing it would only be a matter of time before I was rescued. The upper half of my body had partially dried out, and, although I was still sitting in 2 or 3 inches of slops, half sea water, half urine, in the bottom of the dinghy, the discomfort was tolerable, and I allowed myself to drift away from the reality of the situation. In this complacent mood, I was aware that the waves were slapping harder and harder against the side of the dinghy, but it was not until the first clap of thunder in the distance that I snapped back to my full senses. I opened my eyes wide, and the scene around had changed with unbelievable rapidity. The isolated pinnacles of white cumulus had turned as if by some Machiavellian wand into a solid towering black cliff of cloud bearing down on me and only broken by shafts of lightning. The sea was now a mass of individual waves as the storm built up the wind and water before it. I had time only to check my May West for inflation and secure a few items in the recess of my battle dress before the violent behavior of the dinghy began to require my full attention. It was not long before the waves were 10 to 15 feet high, with crests whipped by the howling wind into a white frenzy of foam. The dinghy lurched in ungainly manner to the top of each wave, where it spun crazily in the boiling caps before dropping sickeningly, half waterlogged, into the deep trough behind. I was now leaning on all my reserves, bailing the dinghy out and facing it into each new wave, using the scoop as a paddle in the knowledge that if the dinghy broached sideways the beaks of the waves would capsize it. I was drenched in water, and the battle became a personal one with the storm itself. I was holding my own until from the top of one wave I saw a monster, towering and boiling above the rest, blotting out the horizon, bearing down with the noise and velocity of an express train. I was suddenly looking up at a wall of water with a cruel white beak curving over me. Dash Christ, I thought, this is it. The dinghy rose protesting until it was almost vertical when the beak snapped it over and over. I remember hanging grimly onto the side while the dinghy rotated around me in the whirlpool of green and white water, then it plunged downwards into the trough behind. I only just managed to climb back onto it before the next wave overtook me, but this time the dinghy behaved in a much more stable way, and I realized that the water flooding it was now acting as ballast and keel. Darkness and the full force of the storm coincided when sky and sea joined into one orchestra of wind, water and drums of thunder, whose stage was illuminated by vivid shafts of lightning. and so the night became the battleground, each wave a charge to repel, each trough a breathing space to regroup and face the next one. I lost all count of the number of times the dinghy capsized that night, only realizing the urgent necessity of righting it and scrambling back inside with the knowledge that the storm had gained more ground as the effort sapped my strength.